From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2015 in Cook County Jail in Chicago. That's where 21-year-old Tyler Smith sat for 7 months waiting for his trial. Smith was arrested for allegedly stealing a phone and a watch. And when he couldn't make bail, which was set at $2,500, his life changed. Smith worked 2 part-time jobs to support himself and his mother. The majority of his income went to everyday expenses like rent and electricity. During the 7 months he was in jail, he lost both of his jobs. Without that income, his family came close to being evicted. Smith told the Christian Science Monitor, quote, "I had lost almost my whole life," end quote. And his case was ultimately dismissed. Smith is one of an estimated 450,000 Americans who are in jail before their day in court. Most of them, like Smith, can't leave because they can't afford bail. Critics of the bail system are calling for change. They say the system is classist and racist, and it perpetuates cycles of poverty, incarceration, and discrimination. Research shows that African-American arrestees are assigned higher amounts of bail and are more likely to remain in jail awaiting trial compared to white arrestees with similar charges. This hour, we'll discuss the bail system in New York and what reformers would like to see changed. That is the subject of an upcoming public forum that will be hosted by the League of Women Voters this Monday night. My guests include some of the panelists who will be there, and they include Tim Donaher, Monroe County Public Defender. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also here is Precious Bedell, founder and director of Turning Points Resource Center. Precious, welcome to you, and why don't you briefly tell us as well some of the work you do with formerly incarcerated women as well?
Thank you for having me, Kevin, and good afternoon, everyone. I work at the University of Rochester with an initiative called WISH, and it is an acronym for Women Supporting Women's Initiative Supporting Health. And we provide services, health care, social services, and reentry services to women recently released from incarceration. And the whole concept behind that is that women are now the fastest growing segment in the prison population. Of course, they're not the majority, and women have different needs than men. So most of the services are more related to men, and there are more services for men than women. And so that's what I do at the university.
Well, thank you for being here. Also here is another panelist for this coming Monday night's forum, and that's Gary Putup, who is the former chapter director here in Western New York with the New York Civil Liberties Union and a former police commander. Gary, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
That event, by the way, Monday night, bail reform, what's it all about? The ethical, practical, and legislative issues. Monday, the 12th of February, starting at 7 p.m., a free public forum at Asbury, First United Methodist Church. Before we get to this discussion, a brief hello from our news director at WXXI News, Randy Gorman, on this, the second to last day of our winter membership campaign. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Evan. We are counting it down, and we are unfortunately behind our goal right now, so we really need your help to hear great programs like this, great information coming up this hour. These are the kinds of topics you hear, not just today, but on a regular basis with Evan Dawson and his producer Megan Mack here on Connections on WXXI. Whatever you can contribute, think of it as a great investment in the future of this program. We have some exciting things planned for the next year or so. And you can call us right now at 454-6300, 454-6300, or you can just go online at WXXINews.org. Whatever you can do, $5, $10, 10 bucks a month, whatever works, will help us continue to bring you great information and programming like you do here every day right here on Connections. Evan?
All right, Randy, thank you very much. And again, listeners, if you are a daily listener and you're not a member, we'd love to have you. 454-6300. I want to read from the Atlantic Monthly, which had a piece just a couple of months ago on the New York bail system and some of the disappointment that many advocates have in a system that should be, according to the New York, according to the Atlantic, much more flexible than it has become. First of all, Tim Donaher, they read about the purpose of bail. This is what the Atlantic writes. People forget bail's essential purpose. It is collateral, meant to guarantee a criminal defendant's return to court. It is not punishment for a person accused of a crime. You want to share your thoughts on the importance of just understanding that point?
Well, that's absolutely correct. I mean, the purpose of bail, the sole reason we have bail, is to ensure a defendant's reappearance in court. Unfortunately, what has developed over the years, over the last 30 years, is that courts are setting increasingly high bail amounts and incarcerating far too many people in pretrial. In fact, the numbers of pretrial incarceration have exploded in the last 30 years across the country. It's just not in New York. While you've seen a corresponding decrease in crime, and we all know that when a person is held pretrial, there are real wrongs that happen in that person's life. They lose their employment, they lose their connection to their family, and more importantly, statistics have shown, or studies have shown, that persons that are held pretrial have a greater incident of being convicted, and they have a greater likelihood of receiving an incarcerative sentence. So those bail decisions that are incarcerating people pretrial are actually leading to greater incidence of conviction when they're compared to similarly situated defendants. So that is a real problem in New York.
And part of the purpose of what The Atlantic wanted to write about was how it works versus how it could work. So let me go ahead and read from that piece, and then, Tim, you can share more of your thoughts on this. Quote, New York's bail law is a product of a progressive overhaul of the bail system in the late 1960s and early 1970s. On paper, it's among the more defendant-friendly nationwide. It requires judges to consider whether a defendant can afford bail, and it lets judges choose from 9 different forms, including options that don't require a defendant to pay anything up front. Yet for almost 50 years, the practice in city courts has failed to conform to the revised law. The law was designed, in the words of the state legislature, to reduce the unconvicted portion of our jail population. But over time, it ended up resulting in more, not less, pretrial detention. According to a report issued last spring by a New York City Criminal Justice Commission, there is precious little evidence that either prosecutors or judges consider a person's ability to pay bail. City judges, the report observes, routinely allow defendants to post only the 2 most onerous forms, cash bail or a bail bond. End quote. A lot to unpack there. Let's start with this. Ability to pay. How often is it considered, and should it be considered every time?
Well, it absolutely should be considered every time. And unfortunately, it's rarely considered by arraigning judges. And the most significant issue that we see when defendants are being arraigned is that oftentimes bail determinations aren't an individualized assessment of the factors that a court is supposed to consider in setting bail, one of which being the ability of that defendant to pay. They become almost pro forma determinations by the court of this level of charge, it becomes this level of bail. But I don't mean to cast aspersions on arraigning courts. There's a lot of blame to go around on why this has occurred. Prosecutors ask for bail in almost every case. Defense attorneys aren't doing a good enough job using those other factors in the bail statute that are mentioned in the Atlantic Monthly.
Why not?
It actually just happened that way, that in every jurisdiction in New York State, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges only considered cash or insurance company bond as the possible bail amounts. They failed to litigate, defense attorneys failed to fully explore their defendants' financial circumstances.
So everyone's got a hand in this.
Everybody's got a hand in this, absolutely. So I don't mean to say that it's only the judge's responsibility, although they are the ones setting bail, but everybody needs to revise their practices to solve this problem.
And so, Tim, to be clear here, for those surprised to hear, there are other options. What are some of the other options?
Well, the other options are, for instance, an appearance bond, whether it's a secured or unsecured. There's a surety bond, where that means that somebody else, like a family member, agrees to pay a certain amount if the defendant fails to appear. And those types of bonds can be unsecured, meaning they're not secured by any property or cash, or partially secured. So there are a variety of ways that a court can accept bail, like an unsecured personal recognizance bond, where you basically say, I promise to appear, but if I don't, I agree that you can come after me for a set amount of money. Or the unsecured or partially secured surety bond. My family will post $100,000 or 10% of that if it's a partially secured bond in order to get you to appear. But that does require a lot of work from both the defense attorney's perspective to explore those options with the client and the family, but it also requires the judge to understand that that's an option and agree to accept that as a form of bail. And as a result, we've sort of defaulted to cash or insurance company bond.
All right, one other point before I turn to our other guests. The Atlantic does add that studies, including a report on New York City released just this past September, suggest that other forms of bail are as effective as cash bail at ensuring a defendant shows up.
Correct. And there are other, even leaving aside the imposition of bail, there are other ways that you can release defendants and have some certainty that they'll return, such as the use of pretrial services organizations. We have an excellent one in Monroe County, and a number of people are released to their supervision. And I think that these programs are significantly underfunded statewide. And if we are going to have bail reform, there needs to be a commitment by the New York State Legislature to fund these organizations. And we may talk about that later in the program.
Okay. I guess the one thing after reading the Atlantic piece that is less clear to me, Tim, is why change anything? Why not just update everyone's understanding within the system that we already have the tools in place legally to do much better than we are doing?
Because after 30 years of the statute being in place, it's clear that it's not working. Its intended effect is has not come to fruition, which is a reduction in the number of people that are being held in pretrial incarceration. The governor's proposal, I don't know if you'd like to talk about that today,
absolutely,
I think does go a long way to trying to fix the current statute statutory scheme, and comes up with real concrete ways that I believe would reduce pretrial incarceration, specifically in Monroe County, but largely upstate New York.
All right, we're going to get to the governor's proposal in a moment. Gary Putt Up is here not just for his work that he's done with the New York Civil Liberties Union, because this is a civil liberties issue, but it's also an issue that involves police. And as a longtime police commander, you're going to be there Monday night talking about this issue. What's the police role, and how do you see that playing into this issue, Gary?
Well, thanks, Evan. About sometime last summer, I was contacted by Metro Justice, the Racial Justice Committee, because there's disparities in how bail is set. Both economically and in an area where we have so much poverty, that we can see that's disparate and desperate and not fair, and it also then therefore ends up affecting disproportionately, especially people and young men of color. So I was asked to explain bail and how it works and how somebody ends up in the system, and so if we want to reform a system, we have to know one what it is and what the problems are. So I was asked basically just to instruct or explain to people how this all starts. And basically it's this: at some point in time, a police officer is going to have contact with someone who ends up under arrest. And the process starts right at that moment. Most officers will then actually talk to the defendant and try to make a determination on their own where it starts. And this is where the discretion comes in. A police officer may feel that, well, this person seems trustworthy, so I'm just going to give them an appearance ticket. It may seem that if he had a hard time with the individual, or based on some of the things that are in the criminal procedure law, think that, like, I'm not sure if this person is going to show up, so I'm going to call a judge and ask for bail. And I'll just give you an example. I spent much of my time out in Zone B in the Monroe County Sheriff's Office. That's Henrietta at Marketplace Mall. If I'm arresting a person there who happens to live in Henrietta, maybe a young person with their family, they're going to school, they've never been in trouble before, or whatever, I might just give them an appearance ticket. If, on the other hand, I run into, or the officer runs into somebody that's come from a dysfunctional family, perhaps doesn't have a job, maybe is dropped out of school, that officer may make the determination that, well, I think this person might be a flight risk and may not show up. One of the interesting things, and when you asked him, is one of the criteria in the decision-making process is listed as the principal's employment and financial resources. And although that can be interpreted in two ways. Well, if the person doesn't have a lot, do you set a low bail? And I think that might be what the intent of that is. But what ends up happening is an officer might feel like, well, this person isn't working, they don't have a lot of money, why would they stay? So they become a flight risk, and then they call a judge. And then you have cases, especially in the suburbs, where you may have a department where the what would be termed in the law as the desk sergeant or a police officer can set pre-arraignment bail. So he might take an offense and never actually even call a judge, and just and there's limits to this, but on their own, just decide that, you know what, I'm not going to bother a judge, and especially if these are late at night when you have to call a judge out, and then they just do it. And if that isn't met, the person ends up, being incarcerated until their arraignment. Some of the things, and I know you've had many guests on the show, and we talk about things like implicit bias. And this is some of the things when we look at things like criteria such as, which is listed again in the law, is character, reputation, habits, family ties. you know, we know that there's implicit bias in all the things that we do. So what happens?
You're not talking about just police. You're talking about society.
Well, I'm talking systemically, yes.
Okay.
And it's you know, and again, it's things that we don't necessarily recognize, but we have to be aware of. So we have to understand that at the very beginning, if officers have an implicit bias against a particular group, a race, an economic, you know, economic group, you know, how is that decision being made? Well, you know, let's just be frank. If this is the good suburban white kid, you know what? He goes home. You know what? If it's the black kid from the city, maybe who's dressed differently, acts differently or whatever, I don't think that it would be surprised to find out that officers may, in those cases, be more inclined to ask for bail. And if I could just add one thing.
Sure.
And part of the problem with this bail, and one of the things I saw, too, is, and you've talked about this on your show before, too, is transportation. And we talk about, and Tim is right, the purpose of bail is to make sure somebody shows back up at court. But one of the problems that we have is, you know, and Karen Morris, a judge from Brighton, deals with this issue quite a bit. I live in the town of Greece. You know, there's no bus service to the town court. There's no bus service, I don't believe, like in certain hours in the evenings, to the town court in Brighton. So unfortunately, if you get arrested and you're poor, and this, again, disproportionately affects the poor, and you're poor, how are you supposed to get to court? You know, it's not always easy. You know, it's not everybody has a car. Not everybody can do this. And if there's no bus service, then what happens is the person ends up missing court. Then a warrant's put out, and their bail ends up being higher, and they sit in jail. And this negative cycle that we've talked about in regards to like how bail negatively affects people and outcomes. You know, one of the things, if I could build on just real quickly on Tim, is one of the things what happens is we know that there's issues with plea bargaining. And we also know that there's times when people will plea bargain to things that they are actually innocent of. Well, if somebody's in jail because they can't make bail and they've been there for weeks or months, you know, they're a lot more susceptible to take a plea bargain to a crime that they haven't committed because they know that they're just going to stay there and they just want to get out. They just want the process to go forward. So this bail has negative consequences in regards to race. It has negative consequences in regards to poverty, and it has negative consequences and actually to justice being done because people aren't necessarily making the best decisions when they're sitting in jail because they haven't met bail.
Gary makes an important point that a lot of people might think, well, no one's going to plead to something they didn't do. He's saying that that desperation just to not be stuck in jail with bail you can't afford will lead people to take deals on crimes they did not commit. Tim Donaher, yes or no?
Oh, absolutely. I often talk to members of the public and they tell me, oh, I would never plead guilty to something I didn't do. And I said, that's just not true. It happens on a frequent basis in our criminal courts. And for one reason that Gary mentions, they're just so desperate to get out of custody, they will plead something to something that they did not do. But it also happens in much more serious cases when they're facing a significantly long sentence. They may agree to plead guilty to something to a lesser charge, even though they didn't do it, in order to get out of custody, to get back to their families. That does happen. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Precious Bedell, the founder and director of Turning Points Resource Center. How do you view the issue of bail, not just incarceration? So a lot of your work is derived from your life experience and the work that you do with primarily with women who have been incarcerated. Mm-hmm. How do you view bail playing into this, Precious?
Well, Turning Points is a prison initiative through my church. And it was founded for the very simple reason that New York State stopped sponsoring transportation to state facilities. So there was at one time a bus that people could take to all of the many, many different facilities throughout New York State. And so we established that so that people could come and not only get information about resources for transportation, but also information about the criminal justice system. And bail is one of the things that people come and they'll say to me, what is that about? You know, what is bail? And how can my family member get out if we don't have that kind of money? And so someone spoke about desperation and plea bargain. Historically, people of color have been in desperate situations many times during their lifetime. So For them to say that they have committed a crime when they haven't committed a crime is not something that is novel to them. So it's not something that's new. But what bail does is dismantles the family. It dismantles them in a way where the story you told from the Atlantic Monthly is just one story. If a person goes to jail, they not only lose their jobs, but they lose their apartment. You know, they lose valuable relationships. They lose their contact many times with their families because their families don't have the time or the resources to stand in a long line downtown and make a visit, make an appointment for a visit. So 9 times out of 10, you just can't call. So I don't know any other system that dismantles families and communities like the criminal justice system does.
Hmm. I want to touch on the proposal that that Tim Donaher, Monroe County Public Defender, alluded to, and that's what Governor Cuomo has floated. So what's going on now, and why don't you kind of lay out the landscape of what this proposal is?
Oh, sure. The governor's proposed the bail reform. It's one of three actual reformations of the criminal justice system he's proposed, and he is proposing to modify the current statutes in really three main ways. The first way would be to prohibit bail being used in misdemeanor and nonviolent felony offenses. In other words, if a person is to be arraigned on an offense for a misdemeanor or a nonviolent felony, the court cannot use bail to guarantee their appearance. They have to use the least restrictive conditions that they can impose to ensure return to court, such as releasing them to the supervision of a pretrial services agency. For violent felony offenses, bail would remain, but the court must do that individualized assessment and place those reasons for setting bail on the record. And the third way that the court, that the governor has modified the, or proposed to modify the bail statute is adding what's called preventative detention to the current bail scheme. That does not exist in New York, but under the governor's proposal, in certain limited crimes, such as serious violent felony offenses, domestic violence cases, or when a person commits a new crime while they've been released, the prosecutor could move for a hearing for the purposes of determining whether that person should be held in custody without bail. And other states have these provisions. The federal system has this provision, but New York has not historically. So the governor has decided to add that or try to add that to the bail statute. My guess is to make it a little bit more palatable in order for it to pass in the New York State Legislature. So those are the three main ways. There are other modifications to the statute as well. But
do you expect it to pass?
If I could predict that, I'd leave my job and become a lobbyist.
But you really don't have a sense for it?
It's so early in the legislative process. I know that it has a lot of support in the defense community. I support it strongly.
What do prosecutors say?
I think they are reserved on it. The District Attorneys Association has come out in not being big fans of the proposal. So I don't know what is going to happen. I think there are going to be obviously changes to the proposal, and we'll see what happens. I do think, however, there is a strong drive to reform the bail system right now in the New York State Legislature.
But do this for me, Tim, because I think in any kind of a debate, it's important to be able to accurately articulate the position of someone who disagrees with you and not make it sort of a caricature or a cartoon. So if there's a prosecutor who doesn't like this proposal, why do they tell you? Why do you think that is?
I think, and again, I wouldn't ever put words in a local prosecutor. We have an excellent office, and I would rely on them to advocate their position. But I have seen the district attorneys take positions that they do not believe that this is a problem in New York, that there aren't individuals that are being held, for instance, on misdemeanors on low bail. They are urging, instead of a reformation of the bail statute, that this issue be studied so we have actual data. I would argue, obviously in opposition, this has been studied over and over and over again.
Years.
Yes, and we have sufficient data to establish that the bail statute is leading to just simply unacceptable levels of incarceration, especially for poor people.
Fred, one of our listeners, emails after hearing Gary Putup describe a police officer's role in this scenario and talking about a police officer deciding, do I need to issue just an appearance ticket? Do I want to ask for bail? What do I want to do based on this? Fred wants to know, in that described scenario, what consequence would an arresting officer have if a defendant does not appear? In other words, you decide, well, we're just going to do an appearance ticket, and if that person doesn't show up, is the officer who had that interaction culpable or dealing with some kind of consequence?
No. First of all, you may never even know. A supervisor wouldn't necessarily know. The person doesn't show up. A bench warrant may be issued. The person will eventually be picked up, and maybe there's a plea bargain or that he pleads out. But there would the police officer or would never be, really be contacted again. And again, because these things are discretionary, even if someone were to say, well, the person didn't show up, the police officer should have asked for bail. I mean, you could get that same argument for judges, for higher ranks, all the way through, and that's always going to be an issue because you can't predict necessarily with 100% accuracy human behavior, but there necessarily wouldn't be any consequences now.
So, Evan, can I just touch on why people don't come to court?
Yes.
And I think Gary had said something about Karen Morris, and she now has an initiative called Ticket to Ride. I'm on her steering committee. And one of the reasons why she created or developed Ticket to Ride is because there are no buses that go out to a lot of the suburban courts where people have court appearances. So Ticket to Ride provides people with bus passes or organizations who are service providers to the population, like the criminal justice population, people who are in substance abuse or mental health programs, so that they can get to court, so that they can get to probation, parole, and other mandated situations so that they don't have to come to court. But a lot of times, a little thing like an alarm clock or a smartphone that we take for granted, poor people don't have those things. They don't have computers or they don't know how to use computers. And we're, engaging people in all of these different initiatives. But, it's really difficult when we are with people who are just bereft of economic and political power.
Okay, Tim, you want to add to that?
Yeah, and I just wanted to add an additional factor. Precious child care is often a problem. They
right.
can't find somebody to care for their
Absolutely.
Kids to go to court. But I'd like to put in a plug for the need for a pretrial services agency to assist. They assist our clients greatly.
Yes,
and
they do.
And with the expansion of services, which of course requires additional funding, you can address a number of these problems. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, obviously, but so I think that there is a provision in the governor's proposal to expand the use of pretrial services agencies to provide this level of support and supervision, and that needs to be supported statewide.
I could add one more thing.
Go ahead, guys. Yeah, go ahead, Precious, first.
Yeah, I'm just going to add one more thing, too. Community health care workers are navigators in the community. I trained them at the University of Rochester, and I started out my job as one. And community health care workers are trusted members in our community, and they may have the same experiences as people about bail and about incarceration and about substance abuse treatment, mental health. So, and funding for them, like with pretrial release, is very, very limited. So, with that, if a person is with a service provider and they call a community health care worker or they hire a community health care worker, that community health care worker is going to teach that person how to navigate the system. That person is going to be a role model to a person that's coming out of the justice system so that they can see someone that's been there and that's their peer, and that they can see that they can go to court, they can resolve this matter, they can do their time if they have to do their time, or they can come out innocent if they're innocent. So part of the process is that we continually involve people on all levels in our community to help disengage people from coming to the criminal justice system, because we just have too many people there that are languishing.
And if I could just add quickly to Evan, one of the reasons sometimes people don't show up is very often people getting arrested are usually younger. It's harder for them to find jobs. Sometimes the jobs they have are service jobs, and if you don't show up for your job, you lose your job. And they don't get to choose when their court date is. And we do have, I personally had cases where people didn't show up for, young men didn't show up for court, because if they had, they would have had to leave their job. And, and as we know, with a lot of like fast food restaurants or whatever, they would lose their jobs. And if we just touch quickly on why people don't show up, I can tell you this. One of our routine duties, at least in the sheriff's office at the zone level, was we would have warrants sent out to the zone and we would serve warrants. I served plenty of warrants on people that had money, homeowners with jobs, that just didn't bother to show up for one reason or another. I think it would be interesting to find out, and again, because this disproportionately affects people in poverty, but I don't know that, you know, that the people that don't show up are necessarily, you know, in that same population. There's people that, don't show up for court and have warrants issued for them, and there's really no excuse. I mean, they own homes, they have cars. You know, it's for issues that are really, we would consider fairly minor. They're not even going to go to jail for, probably just have to pay a fine. And they just choose not to show up.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're late for our only break of the hour. I want to remind you that we are here because there is a forum, a public forum coming up Monday night at 7 p.m. at Asbury First United Methodist Church on East Avenue in Rochester. It's titled Bail Reform, What's It All About? The Ethical, Practical, and Legislative Issues. And our panelists here are going to be there. Tim Donaher, Monroe County Public Defender, Precious Bedell, founder and director of Turning Points Resource Center, Gary Putup, who is a former chapter director with the New York Civil Liberties Union and a former police commander. Let's get that only break of the hour. We'll come back to your phone calls and questions if you have them. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, Eddie Money joins us in studio. One of the most successful rock and roll artists in American history is in Rochester because there's a new musical about his life that makes its world premiere here in Rochester next week. So why did he choose Rochester? What's the music all about? What about his life in rock and roll, in music, his career? Eddie Money joins us in studio next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we get to some of your feedback and continue the conversation on bail reform, let's bring in Randy Gorbin, WXXI News Director, for a brief hello. Hi, Randy.
How are you, Evan? Good. And just looking for some help to continue the great programming that you hear, not only this great kind of talk show, but again, bail issues that we've been talking about in WXXI News, and Evan has as well for a number of months now. And really, to have the level, the caliber of the guests that you hear today and the research that goes into the show, all of that takes resources. We need your help. Our pledge drive is winding down. We are under the goal right now. We still have some distance to go. You can help out by dialing 454-6300, 454-6300, or go online, WXXINews.org. As Evan likes to say, the shortest break in radio, one reason we don't do that is because we are public supported. We don't do commercials. We have very brief announcements. And to continue that kind of programming, we need funding. So please help us out right now, whatever you can, $5, $10, whatever. It will help us continue to bring you topics like this. 454-6300, and thanks in advance for your support, Evan.
All right, Randy, thank you very much. I want to bring in Dylan Hare, who is a member of Just Leadership USA. That's an organization dedicated to cutting the U.S. correctional population in half by the year 2030. And so, Dylan, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for letting me come on.
Yeah, good. So let's talk about bail reform, because we've been hearing about sort of the outlines of how it impacts people in ways that many people who never go through the system don't think about. It's more than just a number that someone has to pay to not go to jail while they're waiting to go back to court. It could have a domino effect, similar, I think, to some of the things that we learned about. And I'm just going to pick one example that was high profile, to Ferguson, when there is sort of a disproportionate taillights policing, and all of a sudden one small ticket becomes the loss of a car, the loss of a job, the change of a life. So we know that this is happening. We know that the evidence is there. But I want to ask you what you think can be done about it and what's realistic.
Sure. So again, thank you for the question. And as you alluded to, there's a lot of evidence and a lot of data that shows that there are real, deeply entrenched problems when it comes to bail and the consequences of being held on bail. And there certainly are moral questions we should be asking about why we're even detaining people who are legally innocent to begin with. But to answer your question about what can be done, one of the things we've done at Just Leadership USA through our Free New York campaign is launch a statewide initiative to urge the governor to do bail reform, speedy trial reform, and discovery reform. And with respect to bail, we have a set of demands and proposals that will eliminate cash bail, will eliminate this idea of wealth-based detention, will create a presumption of release so that people who are arrested and charged with a crime are deemed to be released unless the prosecution can show some overbearing reason why they should not be. So there are several steps we can take in the short term that we hope the legislature and the governor will take that would begin to eradicate or at least address some of these serious problems.
Dylan, what do you make of some of the arguments that you might hear from whether it's prosecutors or just those who, look, I've gotten an email this hour from a listener saying, if this is a problem, don't commit a crime in the first place. And I, you know, Tim Donaher just winced a little at that remark.
Me too.
But we hear, I think everybody did, but but you do hear that. So let's start with that, Dylan. Why don't you take that one first?
Yeah, sure. So just real quick, if you don't mind, I'll take both real quick. I actually used to be a prosecutor in Massachusetts, so I completely understand the idea that prosecutors want to hold on to all the power and discretion they can in a courtroom proceeding. And bail and the ability to demand bail and essentially set bail, because judges give a lot of deference to prosecutors, is an incredibly powerful tool that a prosecutor has in the criminal justice process. So I get the desire to hold on to it, but that doesn't make it right. And to answer the question about, well, if you don't want to be in this situation, don't commit a crime in the first place. I mean, there's so many things we could say about that. First of all, most people, a vast majority of people who are alleged to have committed a crime were victims of a crime in the recent past. So it's not just this idea that there's a few bad people doing bad things. There's a cycle of victimization and criminalization that happens in communities across the state and across the country, where people who are caught up in the system tend to have been a part of the system at another point in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, too, the results of when we find someone who's being held on bail, has been arraigned on a charge, or is accused of committing a crime, that more often than not has to do with the way their communities are policed and monitored and, quite frankly, targeted by the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
Much more than it has anything to do with what they actually did or didn't do. So, and it feeds itself, right? So we know for a fact that if you are held for even a short amount of time pre-trial, you are more likely to take a guilty plea in your case. And we know for a fact that if you are found guilty, if you're convicted guilty of a crime, it's harder for you to get housing, get a job, get education, get all sorts of things that you need to live your life. And we know for a fact, if you can't do those things, that your community continues to suffer, you cannot contribute to your community, and the grip the criminal justice system has and victimization and criminalization has in your community only gets worse. And then we know for a fact, when that happens, you're back to square one, where you're being overpoliced, over-targeted, rearrested, and here we are again, you back in the system with no way out.
Precious, you want to weigh in? Go ahead.
Yeah, and Dylan, what we didn't talk about is that all of those instances that you just described are embedded and seeped in discrimination and systemic racism against people of color, who are disproportionately incarcerated more. And now that we have the opiate epidemic, poor white women and poor white men out in rural counties are incarcerated. We're using incarceration for the wrong thing. People who have drug problems, that is a public health problem. That is not a criminal problem. But there's a paradox, because people commit crimes for drugs. And instead of us investing money into treatment and prevention prior to this, we're investing millions of dollars into the criminal justice system, and it's just not working. So we're saying, okay, well, let's take a look at this because it's about money. But it's really not about money. It is about human lives. It is about the humanity of our country, a great country, allegedly, that we have here, that is supposed to take into consideration everyone who has a dream can make that dream come true. And if we continually have these policies where people are treated differently, how can we have that American dream?
All right,
you're absolutely right. And one thing I would say is that the criminal justice system, in large part, is the latest iteration in a series of efforts this country has taken to marginalize and discriminate against people of color. There's a direct line that can be drawn from our original sin to Jim Crow to segregation to the civil rights battles to mass incarceration today. And you can easily paint the line and see the dots and see the connections. And so for anyone who thinks that the system does not disproportionately impact people of color, just look at the data. Any city or state across this country will tell you that it does.
All right, so Tim Donaher, you kind of flinched a little when I read the email from a listener who says, don't commit crimes in the first place. Go ahead, hit that one.
Well, I think it shows a fundamental lack of understanding about the fact that people that are held pretrial have a legal presumption of innocence. We're saying to them, in one sense, the law is going to say that we're presuming that you're innocent, but we're also going to hold you pretrial with all of the negative effects that will come from that. And it turns it into something that you and I discussed earlier. It becomes the pretrial detention becomes punitive.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that make any sense to that listener who made that comment, that if the law says you're innocent, we're also going to punish you by holding you pretrial? That makes no sense to me. But I'd like to make a quick observation. If that listener got pulled over for a traffic infraction and was dragged out of his or her car and placed in handcuffs and taken down and spent the night in jail for something relatively minor, which happens every day for violation-level offenses in Monroe, disorderly conduct or trespassing, that person would be outraged, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen to those types of persons. It happens to people of color in the city of Rochester who are poor. They commit relatively minor level offenses. They get taken in front of a judge. The judge sets bail. They have no chance of making where you and I could make that amount, $75, $250. We'd be able to post that bail. That poor person, who's likely a person of color, will stay in jail because they can't make that. They just do not have the money.
Two points to what Tim is saying there. The reason that we opened the hour the way we did with the story of 21-year-old Tyler Smith in Chicago is not because it's an outlier, but because this is a very real concern in this country. He was someone who was charged with stealing a phone and a watch. His case was ultimately dismissed, but he spent 7 months in jail because he couldn't make a $2,500 bail, lost two different jobs and the ability to support himself and his mother, and for something that ultimately gets tossed out in a legal system. So, Tim, the second point I kind of want to hit on is you're working with prosecutors, and I know you've got a good relationship and a lot of respect for your colleagues in the DA's office, for example, but what are they routinely asking for when it comes to bail?
Oh, I would like to reiterate, I respect them greatly, but it gets back to what I observed earlier. The whole bail system has become so pro forma, it lacks that individualized assessment of the defendant that oftentimes district attorneys will walk in and quote a bail amount that has nothing to do about the defendant's personal circumstances or even what happened in the alleged underlying crime. It just becomes a pro forma amount, for instance, $5,000, $10,000 for a lower-level felony. And oftentimes prosecutors, by the way, aren't even present when there's an arraignment. They will call the arresting officer, and the arresting officer will convey the bail amount they're suggesting. And they don't have any information in front of them. They receive the information from the arresting officer. What happened? Was the guy cooperative? Was he not cooperative? And they just, as I said, throw out a figure that, unfortunately, a lot of judges take with great weight. And the judge fails to do an individualized assessment of the factors that they're supposed to consider, which has led to this problem of significant numbers of pretrial incarceration. And so as you mentioned earlier, why fix the system? Because although the statute requires people to do certain things, those things are not being done. And we really need to address this problem.
Gary?
You know, for better or worse, you know, Evan, earlier you asked about the politics. And just as a quick aside, I'm going to guess in New York State it passes the assembly, then the real fight will be in the Senate. And why prosecutors and district attorneys don't support something like this is that we do have to keep in mind they're elected officials. And the problem that we have is, you know, and again, not to disparage any particular district attorney, but the problem you have is in some counties where they're running, you certainly don't want to be running on a platform of that you're the candidate that, as our caller said, is letting criminals go to, you know, commit more crimes.
I think they would argue I understand Tim's point, and I'm not trying to put words in anybody's mouth either, but the district attorney in this county herself and many other prosecutors have said their job is keeping people safe, and that if in the course of their work there are people who end up incarcerated held for a time before trial, that is part of the system and that's part of the duty of theirs to at least pursue the safety of the public. And so that's why when Jillian emails me and says, Evan, who or what industries or stakeholders in the criminal justice system would lobby against this reform? Again, I think what we have is a situation where prosecutors would say, Gary, look, we're just trying to keep people safe.
Well, I think we have to go back to actually the first duty of a prosecutor is that justice is done. And keeping people safe, yeah, that's certainly a priority. And we can do that. But I don't know that, you know, we talk about data. We talk about, you know, the facts. I don't know, especially in a lot of these cases, these are property crimes and not necessarily violent crimes. We're not necessarily making the community safer by sending somebody's, you know, kids to jail and just having them sit there. But I think, again, if we go back to what their first priority is to do justice, then that's what the priority should be, and that's why they should be supportive. But again, it's going to be hard to run a political campaign based on that.
Okay.
Can I say one thing?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Dylan.
There's study after study that shows as well, when you compare people who are released pretrial and people who are held on bail, the data shows that there's really no difference at all between people who are alleged to have recommitted a new crime, people who are alleged to have not shown up to court dates. Bail is not actually holding people on bail, holding people pretrial, is not actually having any sort of discernible impact. In fact, in many instances, it lowers the rates that people have of successfully completing the criminal justice process, and it makes communities less safe in the long run. So it's not even an argument that can, that makes sense in the face of data that's come out over the last several years.
All right. And so in the numbers I've seen in various places, roughly 450,000 Americans are in jail at any given time awaiting trial or before their day in court because they're not making bail. Tim Donaher, what ideally, what do you think that number should be?
Oh boy, that's a difficult question.
One tenth?
Well,
let me
put it in a historical perspective. 30 years ago, prior to the war on crime, the numbers were a fraction of that, less than 150,000.
And what we've more than tripled it.
We've more than tripled it in 3 decades, while the crime rate since the 90s has gone down precipitously.
So prosecutors might argue, see, maybe there's a correlation.
We knew you were going to say that.
Well, yeah, I know what the arguments are.
Yeah,
that could
you
be
do,
a,
Evan,
a
and poten- I do too.
There could be a potential argument to that, except that there have been study after study that have established that, as Dylan just pointed out, that pretrial incarceration does not lead to a reduction in crime.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened as we've seen a reduction in incarcerative sentences because of the reduction in crime, the jails have expanded with greater and greater numbers of persons being held pretrial. And that's occurred in New York State, and it's occurred across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you're seeing this, I think, issue has such passion in our community and in the New York State legislature and the governor, in that they see this as just a injustice that needs to be remedied.
Yes. And Tim, mass incarceration is not about the 2 million people that are incarcerated. It's about 9 million people under correctional control. So maybe that's where some of this reduction comes from. So people are either on parole, on probation, or they're on a house arrest, or they have the ankle bracelet or something like that. And again, we always talk about, oh, how much money it costs. And another thing is that we keep the community safe. We've never, ever really looked at the history of incarceration. We look at it, but we don't look at it in a way of how it still resonates in the communities and in the criminal justice system and how it hasn't worked and how can we make it work better, okay? And one of the things I think that we really have to really look at is that the impact of incarceration on families, it also increases intergenerational incarceration. So when a person goes to jail or to prison, especially a male counterpart, and he's the person that's the financial provider for the family, then a lot of the money is missing. So that brings on a lot of stress for people, and I'm not making any excuses, but people commit crimes to live.
And if I could say, Evan, too, if that was a valid argument, considering that of first world nations, that we incarcerate more people than anyone else at such a high rate, then there should almost be like no crime in the United States.
Absolutely.
I mean, so it's really, you know, I mean, our very situation with crime and the number of people we incarcerate, it seems to invalidate that argument.
Yeah, and I would just say, you know, Tim's right that in over 30 years, crime has gone down. Violent crime has gone down. The number of shooting incidents shooting deaths have gone down. But there, especially when you look at gun crime, it's still remarkably high compared to other, what we might call industrialized
nations.
That's
when we start looking. When we start looking internationally, comparing ourselves to others, that's what we have to do.
Okay, I know it's a complex picture, but let me ask Dylan Hare as we get ready to close the hour here. Your organization is dedicated to cutting the U.S. correctional population in half by 2030. So let me ask you what I asked Tim Donaher, Monroe County Public Defender. If there's almost 500,000 Americans who are in jail before their day in court, most of them because they can't make bail, what's a realistic number? What should that number be, and what do you think is realistic?
Theoretically, I think the number should be zero. And as far as it's realistic,
I like that answer.
As far as it's realistic, when you set a high goal, when you reach for the highest hanging fruit, everything else becomes low hanging fruit. So let's shoot for zero, because my question is this. I have yet to hear a justification for caging a human being
who is legally
innocent.
Flight risk.
Then there are things we can do that can ensure that their return to court happens. First of all, like I said, the data shows that the flight risk problem is not worsened or alleviated by bail or pretrial release. The data shows that it's consistent across the board, that people tend to want to show up to court to resolve their cases, and the ones who don't are going to find a way not to regardless. Second of all, if you are concerned that someone's a flight risk, there are light touch things you can do, whether it's having a regular check-in with a parole or probation officer or pretrial, whether it's having some sort of a regular check-in with the court. There are things we can do that we know work within the community that will help that person continue to be integrated in their community, will not disrupt their life, will not take them away from a job, from their family, from their housing, from everything else, will not negatively impact the chances they have to succeed or at least have a constitutional due process play out in their case. We can protect all those things and still protect what prosecutors want to tell us is the safety and the justice of their community.
All right, Dylan, because we're going to lose the hour, why don't you let our listeners know where you are online?
Sure. So justleadershipusa.org is our website, and you can find information about all our campaigns and get in touch with us through there pretty easily. We're also on social media at Just Leaders USA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Thanks for taking the time for the program today, Dylan.
Thank you, Dylan.
All right. Have a good day.
Monday night, 7 p.m. at the Asbury First United Methodist Church. It's a forum sponsored by the League of Women Voters. It's called Bail Reform, What's It All About? The Ethical, Practical, and Legislative Issues. Again, that's at 7. It's a free forum. And our guests here in studio will be there. Precious Bedell, thanks for taking the time to be here. It's good to see you here.
Good to see you too, Evan.
Also, thanks to Tim Donaher, Monroe County Public Defender. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
And Gary Putup, a longtime police commander and former director of the local chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Gary, thanks for your time as well.
It's nice to see you again, Evan.
All right, short break and more connections is coming up.